Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is currently Thursday afternoon. My name is Rob Dosser. I am sitting here in the bowels of U.S. Bank Stadium. Is that what this is called?
Sure.
U.S. Bank Stadium, right outside the Minnesota Vikings team locker room, Sam Vecenie from The Athletic. And we are going to talk all about our favorite picks for the games this weekend. Sam, what's going on, man? How you doing?
I'm excited to see that little message pop up on the Jumbotron or whatever that says, you're not allowed to gamble. Please no gambling on the NCAA tournament. We are a gambling-free environment here as an organization, the NCAA.
I would never, ever gamble on the NCAA tournament. Just so people know, if you do hear any noise in the background, we are sitting in a hallway. We are where people are walking by. This is live recorded at Media Day from the Final Four. So that is where we are. That is what we're doing. We're going to start off with the first game of the weekend. It is Virginia. It is Auburn. Virginia's favored by 5.5. The total, last I saw, was 131. Sam, where do you stand on this game?
So it's a really interesting one. I think that there's just a chance that Auburn shoots over the pack line and makes it a circumstance where Virginia can't really do anything, like we saw with Purdue last time. That, you know, if you have a guy that can knock down shots, can knock down 10 threes in a game, you can catch them defensively. Bryce Brown, he has that capability. Jared Harper has the capability of going out and getting penetration against guys like Ty Jerome, Kyle Guy, etc. I'll be really interested to see the way that Virginia deploys DeAndre Hunter in this game, because whoever they throw Hunter on is probably going to be taken out of the game to an extent, although Carson Edwards kind of proved the antithesis, but I think that's kind of a...
Sometimes guys make shots, and sometimes guys are going to make a shot. Doesn't matter who you guard. Great offense is going to be great defense.
Make or miss league.
Yep, exactly.
Either you make shots or you're missing. So I'm going to be really interested to see the way Virginia matches up with them, but at the end of the day, I'm taking the Hoos. I can't get past that. I can't get past the fact that Virginia, for me, has been one of the two best teams all year, and Auburn, for the most part, up until this last month, has been really disappointing to me, to be honest.
The big thing for me with Auburn is so much of what they want to do is score transition. They turn defense into offense. They turn missed shots. They turn turnovers. They do all of this, and they turn it into offense, whether it's the quick hit and head passes, whether it's points in transition. I think they made more transition threes than anybody else in college basketball this year. And the thing with Virginia is, one, they're always going to send three guys back on defense.
Never
fails. If not four. Yep. They don't care about getting offensive rebounds. That's just not what they do. And the other thing is, they don't turn the ball over. They are not going to make mistakes. They're not going to let Auburn force them into situations where they've got live ball turnovers that turn into quick threes at the other end of the floor. That's just not what they do. And if you are Virginia and you can't take you can take away the transition game from Auburn, do they have enough guys to be able to beat the pack line defense? And the answer is maybe. They might. You know, Bryce Brown,
yeah.
Jared Harper. And here's the other thing about it. I was talking with the coach about this. Auburn's built kind of the same way that UMBC is.
Similarly, for sure. Yeah.
They're not exactly the same, but it's the same kind of style. They're going to play small ball. They're going to play four out. They're going to have a lot of shooting. And the thing about this Virginia team is they are built differently than last year's Virginia team. They are legitimately built so that when Tony Bennett runs into teams that want to play the way that UMBC wanted to play, they can adjust to that. And we had a chance to talk with some of the assistants today on Virginia. It's not a mistake that they're playing smaller. It's not a mistake. It's not a coincidence that they're running more ball screen continuity instead of just the block remover. Like, this is intentional. They thought about this. They realized that there was a problem with what they were doing, and they changed it.
Right. Well, the big thing, too, is having DeAndre Hunter back allows you to do that.
Yeah, he's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, he's actually useful. There's a reason that he's a top five pick in the NBA draft, in my opinion. Like, he is a genuine mismatch nightmare on both ends of the floor for Virginia. But I think that particularly, you look at what happened at the end of the Purdue game, right? The last four possessions, even though DeAndre Hunter sat out the end of regulation, he sat out the first couple of minutes of overtime, those last four possessions of the game against Purdue, they went to DeAndre Hunter.
Yep.
He scored twice. He had 4 points in those four possessions. Mm-hmm. That ended up being the difference in the game, was him being able to take advantage of his mismatch and score those 4 points. So I do look at this as a circumstance where having a guy like DeAndre Hunter allows you to do more ball screen continuity. because they have multiple ball handlers. They have more mobile, more positionally diverse players, and it allows you to do just more creative actions. And look, like, ball screen continuity isn't exactly breaking the wheel or anything. It's not like breaking news, but it is a certain, it is a kind of style that you need versatile players. You need to be able to run four out to an extent to be able to be successful.
And the other thing, the other point that's interesting, and I got this from both the coaches that I talked with when it comes to like scouting Virginia, or scouting Auburn, is that what they want to do, like, they'll press you and they lead the country in turnover percentage and steal rate.
Yep.
But this, we're not talking about like a VCU press. We're not talking about press Virginia. They're not trapping you in the backcourt.
No, they're not.
They're not getting all over. The press they run is a token press. You're going to make mistakes against it every once in a while, and you're going to have a couple turnovers, and they know that. But it's mostly just to control the play pace and to control the tempo of the game, to get the shot clock down. And what they want to do is turn you over in the half court. When you drive and hit a gap, they're coming in with quick hands trying to swipe the ball away.
Yep.
They are getting out and pressuring you when you want to run your offense and trying to jump passing lanes. They basically just want to fuck you up, whatever you do in the half court. They don't want to let you run your stuff. And the thing about Virginia is you can't fuck them up. You can't get them out of what they want to do. And I just think that this is the nut low matchup, nut worst. It couldn't be worse than this.
So it's interesting because, like you said, Virginia, they've turned the ball over on, according to Synergy, this is 12.4% of their offensive possessions this season. That is 10th nationally.
That's a very low number.
It's a very low number. But it's interesting because while I agree with Rob that Virginia, in terms of the way that they limit transition and in terms of the way that they limit their own turnovers, is a disaster matchup for Auburn, I really do think that Auburn's offensive side, with how they chuck up threes, with how they want to, you know, because what Virginia does is they want to sink back defensively in transition. Mm-hmm. They want to get back. They want to touch the paint and then push out on you defensively in transition. They don't necessarily always pick up, you know, immediately on the break. And look, Tony Bennett's smart enough to adjust this, right? Like, if I'm seeing this and Rob's seeing this, Tony Bennett's fucking seeing it. You know what I mean?
Yes,
like, there's no question about that. But it'll just be interesting to see how many transition threes does Auburn get, because it's a very different scheme from what teams see most of the time. And Jared Harper's playing just incredibly well. I'm trying not to drop too many F-balls, but Jared Harper is playing unbelievably well right now. And he has the ability to be able to get penetration against guys like Ty Jerome, against guys like Kyle Guy. And honestly, I kind of think that he can take advantage of DeAndre Hunter in the same way that Carson Edwards sort of took advantage of DeAndre Hunter.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about them is Bryce Brown is fully capable of doing what Carson Edwards did. I don't know if he'll go for 42, but he could certainly hit 6-7 threes in a half. And I don't think any of us would be surprised. Like, that's the thing about Auburn is this was actually the way that it was phrased to me by one coach when I was doing these scouting reports, is that Auburn is the best matchup for Virginia. They are also the worst matchup for Virginia.
That's right.
And this sounds really simplistic and really just basic, but it all comes down to whether or not they make their shots.
Right.
Because Virginia's going to give them threes. And if they shoot 15 for 35 from three, which is something that is certainly possible, then Auburn has a very good chance to win this game. If they shoot 7 for 35 from three, then they could lose by 15 points.
Yeah, I agree.
And there's that all of those things are all within the realm of possibility. They're all they all could happen. And I don't think that it's something that you could predict.
Well, it's a really interesting thing, too, because a lot of it comes down to what coaching staff do you trust? What coaching staff do you trust to make adjustments on the fly in-game when something starts working? Because, like we said, both these teams are going to do things that cause the other one problems.
Yep.
So which staff do you trust to make adjustments on the fly? I actually think both these staffs are really good.
They're both great.
Yeah.
They're both great coaches.
They're actually both unbelievable coaches. This is not a situation where, you know, like we talked about, like, no shade to Tony Benford or anything. Like, you know,
no shade to Tony Benford, but he sucks.
Well, we talked during the last preview about, Tom Izzo going against a guy that, you know, was a coach at North Texas, but, you know, just took over at LSU and is not Tom Izzo, realistically. Like, we can just say that. So there's no real massive coaching advantage here, I don't think. Talent-wise, that's why I'm going to bet on Virginia, I think. I think they just have the pros.
Well, the thing is, and we haven't talked about this yet, but no Chuma Okeke in this situation
Huge.
Is really, really bad.
Because Malik Dunbar is going to be able to handle DeAndre Hunter to an extent.
I think the bigger thing is on the offensive end of the floor, because what Chuma does, like what basically coaches are going to do when they play Auburn is they're going to focus in on Bryce Brown and they're going to focus in on Jarrett Harper. But what you're going to have to do at some point is you're going to have to think about switching because of what Auburn runs, the way that they run it, and the fact that everybody can basically play out on the perimeter.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to at least think about it. And when Chuma Okeke's on the floor, you cannot switch on him from big to little, because what Auburn will do is they'll run a set to get him the ball wherever it needs. Like, if you end up with a center on him, they'll run a set so he gets ISO'd on the wing so he can beat your center off the dribble. If he gets little switched on him, they're going to throw him in the post, and you're going to get buried.
Right.
And he is the guy that lets them do that. D'Angelo Purifoy, Malik Dunbar, Anfernee McLemore, these guys are the same kind of player, but they are nowhere near as good at taking advantage of a mismatch the way that Chuma Okeke is. And what that means...
Well, it's a question of ball skills. Yeah, like, those guys don't have the ball skills.
They're just not as good. Yeah. I mean, they're good players. Like, they're great role players, but they're just not as good. Chuma Okeke is a first-round pick.
Yeah, he's like a border...
He's going to play in the NBA.
He's going to play in the NBA, assuming the knee injury doesn't end up holding him out too much. Okeke has actual ball skills. Guys like, you know, Anfernee McLemore, who can step away and knock down a shot, just don't have the ball skills to attack a closeout, for instance. Mm-hmm. You have to close out on him hard because he can't take advantage of you driving to the basket. Chuma Okeke, you can't really do that, because if you close out heavy, he's going to be able to get by you. If you close out light, he's going to knock down the shot. That's a huge difference.
If you switch, he's
going to
kill you in the post. If you switch on a big, he's going to kill you from the perimeter. And if you just have a normal, regular guy guarding him, he might be able to win that matchup too. He's just a very, very good basketball player. You talk to coaches, they'll say Bryce Brown is the most dangerous. They'll say Jarrett Harper runs everything, but Chuma Okeke is their best basketball player.
Yep.
And not having him just takes away – it allows them to focus more on Bryce Brown and Jarrett Harper, and that is not always a good thing for Auburn. So are we both on the same page here? It's probably – if you're going to bet on it, it's going to be Virginia minus 5.5.
Yeah.
What do you think about the total?
I like the over. I like the over quite a bit. As we've seen, Virginia's been a little bit more potent offensively,
they're willing to run, they're willing to shoot. They're not as reliant on just running 30 seconds off the clock every single time.
Right. Like, the game that Virginia has struggled most offensively in this tournament is Oregon, where Oregon will legitimately just run back, sit in that zone, and cause problems in terms of, like, not getting out in transition. Auburn wants to run with you. They want to try and beat you down the floor. And I think that because Virginia is running more fluid offense, we'll say, more offense that doesn't necessarily require large, like, 10-second setups once they get into the half court, they can run more early offense. They can run more secondary break offense. And that's huge. I think that's a huge reason why they're going to end up, in my opinion, winning the national title.
Yeah, I think so too.
But, you know, I think that more for this game particularly, that's why we're going to hit the over.
Yep. All right, so Virginia and the over. Let's move on. We have Michigan State is favored right now by 2.5 against Texas Tech. The total there is 132.5. Sam, where do you land on this one? I think this is an absolutely fascinating matchup because, again, it is two teams that on one end of the floor, what Texas Tech does defensively is designed to take away what Michigan State does offensively. And what Michigan State does offensively is the way that you beat what Texas Tech does defensively.
To an extent, I agree with that, because at the end of the day, they do want to go no middle. That is just the number one rule for Texas Tech. They want to be able to stop you from going middle. They want to force you baseline, and they want to force you into the help. I worry that against Michigan State, because Cassius Winston is so good at dictating tempo, he's so good at directing his big man into screens and getting himself into the middle of the floor, this is the kind of matchup where Texas Tech's defense, I don't want to say can be taken advantage of, because no one's ever going to take advantage of Texas Tech's defense, but it could be a circumstance where Texas Tech has to adjust the way that they cover ball screens. You know, this is something that I think is underrated with Texas Tech. They don't have one way of defending ball screens. They really just kind of go about it in whatever way they think will stop you. Some teams, like Virginia, for instance, they want a hard hedge out on just about every ball screen if they can. Texas Tech does different stuff. You go back and watch the Duke game, they'll switch out on the guys. You go back and watch, I'm trying to think, like, what's an example of a game where they set back and you know, just play drop coverage?
They did that against Texas one game.
Yes.
They do it against, if they know that you can make a bunch of threes, they have no problem sitting back and not helping and just kind of getting into more of a, I guess, basic is maybe the word, a less aggressive. Because normally what they want to do is they want to take you out of what you know.
Right.
They want to...
And nobody's better at it.
Yeah, and it's called four in the box. And the way to think about it is if you take a line from the middle of half court, from the center circle, and draw it straight to the basket, think about breaking the half court up into two halves. They want to keep you on one half of the floor, and they want to put four guys in that half of the floor to make it so that they have the numerical advantage. They're going to make you drive. You're going to get forced baseline, and they're going to try to make you drive straight into a guy that is standing just outside the block, so he's going to take the charge on.
Which, by the way, those two guys tend to be either Norin Zodiasi, who is 6'9", 250 pounds, and is a brick wall of verticality, or it's going to be Tariq Owens, who is 6'11", long as shit, and like
super athletic.
Mm-hmm. Like, I was talking to someone today in their locker room, and I was like, you guys are going to miss Tariq big time next year because of his mobility, because of the way that he allows you to run different type of ball screen actions. So, like, I look at this and I'm fascinated in this matchup in so many different ways. Like, how Texas Tech guards ball screens versus how Cassius Winston tries to negate the way they're guarding ball screens. Mm-hmm. It's like a genius matchup in so many different ways.
Yes, because there is nobody better at doing what Texas Tech does than Texas Tech. And there's nobody better at doing what Cassius Winston does than Cassius Winston.
100%.
The thing that's interesting to me, where I think that they're going to actually be able to have an advantage, is that Michigan State and Tom Izzo, I don't know if people really recognize this about Tom Izzo because it's certainly not the reputation that he has, but he might be the best coach when it comes to teaching fast break offense.
Yeah.
Not named Roy Williams. They get out and they run. Cassius Winston is one of the best in the world when it comes to that hit ahead pass.
Yep.
And it's not, he's not like this, world class sprinter. He's not going to win a gold medal.
No, he's not.
But what he can do is he just keeps coming and coming and coming. And he is the guy, every single pass that that you can throw that is possible to throw up the court in transition. Look, there were two times in the Duke game where they beat Duke down the floor in transition for a layup off a missed free throw or off a made free throw.
It's crazy.
A made free throw leads to a transition layup. And that's because of what Cassius Winston is able to do when it comes to that hit-ahead pass. The other thing about it is that another one of the ways that you can beat what Texas Tech does is you need to, one, run offense from the middle of the floor, which is something that Michigan State does a lot of. And two, when you get your offense on one side, you need to be able to run it high and wide and have plenty of off-ball action and weak side action.
Yeah.
And that is something that Michigan State does a lot of. They have a lot of weak side pin downs. They have a lot of plays that involve Cassius Winston coming to one side of the floor, using him as a decoy, and having the action on the other side, whether it's like
they'll run a lot of drift action going up toward the wing. They'll run some back cut action going toward the basket. They do a lot of different stuff.
Yeah, one of the things that they actually did, so everybody saw the game winner where Cassius Winston set the pin down for Kenny Gomes, right? That was a counter to something they ran earlier in that Duke game where Cassius Winston ran the pin down, but then he immediately came off a flare screen for Nick Ward, and then all of a sudden he's on the other side of the floor with an open side, nothing but him and Nick Ward to run a ball screen. And that's the kind of stuff that you have to be able to run to beat this Texas Tech defense. That's the kind of stuff that Michigan State does.
No question. And the other interesting aspect of this is, in terms of looking at this negatively for Michigan State, they've had turnover problems in the past with Cassius Winston. Texas Tech is obviously incredible at digging down, getting their hands in the post, getting their hands on different ball handlers once you get in that box of four men basically on one side of the floor. Now, they've been a lot better in this NCAA tournament at reducing turnovers. You look at their numbers against Duke, they turned it over on 10.3% of their possession. Against LSU, 11.2%. Against Bradley, 13.3%. You can even go back to the Big Ten title game, 15% against Michigan. That's a number that's fine. Texas Tech is going to turn you over on 23% of their possessions about on average. If Michigan State can keep that number below 20% in this game, I think it's going to be impressive, first and foremost. And I think that it'll tell you who wins the game. I think that Michigan State turnover number is going to be the key number in this game for anyone.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And I wonder if – I'm going to be very curious to see how they decide to guard these ball screens.
Yeah.
And they're like we spent time with them last night on Wednesday night, and
hot take, they didn't tell us what they were going to do.
Yeah, they didn't tell us what they were going to do. I didn't ask. I don't want to know. Don't want to put that on them. But I will say this. Whatever happens with Texas Tech, I don't think that there is a program that is more prepared when it comes to situations like this. So
these dudes watch tape until like
4 o'clock in the morning.
And we're talking like full staff, like not just like, you know, Chris Beard, not even just the assistants. Everyone on their staff watches tape until.
So how about this? We walked in, we were in their hotel at 1 o'clock in the morning at the ballroom that they had. Right.
And
they were watching film. Right. Yeah. Today, we walk into their locker room for the opening locker room media session at 1 o'clock PM today on today's Thursday.
Yep.
And you know what Mark Adams was doing? You know what Sip was doing? You know what Berg wasn't watching, but the GAs were doing?
Yep.
They were watching film. There were four people in the back room sitting on their laptops watching film.
And you had to interrupt them.
I had to interrupt them to get Mark. He was good about it, though. So I think, I don't know. Honestly, here's my kind of take on this. The spread is 2.5. I think this is a pick 'em.
I agree.
I think these teams are equal.
Dead even.
So I'm just going to take the 2.5 points. And that's all that's all my logic is that I think that both these teams, when it comes down to it, you play a 10-game series, they win 5-5. You play a 7-game series, it comes down to the final possession of game 7.
100%.
So if you're going to give me 2.5 points, then I will just take the 2.5 points. If you're going to say I can get plus 130 odds on the money line instead of minus 150 or whatever it is, I'm going to take the plus 130 odds. And that's really what it comes down to for me.
Yeah, I agree. 100%. I think that's the way to handle it.
Where are you at on the total for this one?
Nowhere.
I don't think I want. I'm going to stay away from the total.
I think I'm going to stay away from the total. If you made me pick a side, I think I would say under, if only because these two teams are going to do whatever they can to take away the other team's primary actions. And I think they're going to be more focused on how to stop you versus how to score on you. Just generally, both of these coaching staffs are defensively oriented.
Yep.
Just by nature. And I think they're going to be more focused on that. I think they're going to be a lot more focused on trying to figure out the best way to stop the opposition. And that's not to say, like, you know, they're not smart enough to create an offensive game plan. It's just that's the best way to do it.
And that's the way it's going to end up playing out. Well, listen, Sam, I appreciate the time.
Do we want to talk about UCLA? We want to laugh at UCLA real quick. Do we want to
give me any UCLA takes that you have?
Hot take on UCLA. They did pretty good hiring Jamie Dixon. If they hire Jamie Dixon, it looks like it might fall apart. Like, who knows what's going to happen here? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. Seems like it's a buyout issue right now. Jamie Dixon's a good coach. Jamie Dixon has 400 wins in his career.
He's fine. Here's the thing about
it. Here's what I'll tell you. Jamie Dixon has 400 wins in his career, 396 or something like that. We just had a conversation with a couple of media members. Is Bruce Pearl a Hall of Famer if he wins a national title? Jamie Dixon has like 60 more career wins than Bruce Pearl.
At Division I.
Bruce
Pearl has like 300 or something like that at Division II. And I agree with all that. Here's the only reason why people think this is a bad hire. As soon as UCLA opened, Jamie Dixon was one of like the three names. And everybody, Earl Watson, Jamie Dixon is what people threw out there, right?
You and I podcasted on my podcast the day that it happened at 10 o'clock on December 30th. You and I podcasted at 10 a.m. on December 31st. And I said, Jamie Dixon's going to be the next head coach of UCLA. I predicted that would be my pick.
The problem here is that we all thought it was going to be Jamie Dixon, Earl Watson, Fred Hoiberg, somebody like that. Then, we're going to get Luke Walton. We're going to get John Calipari. Oh, they're calling Tony Bennett. Oh, they want Jay Wright. Oh, we're going to get somebody like this. Oh, we're going to get this huge splash hire because we're UCLA and we're back. And you know what? You're not back because you're struggling with an $8 million buyout. If you were UCLA and you were living up to that blue blood standard, you would pay the $8 million buyout.
You just got boosters together to pay John Calipari potentially $8 million a year. And they got boosters together to handle the private plane problems that, you know, UCLA has struggled with in the past, chartering planes and everything. John Calipari obviously hasn't flown private in a decade, or hasn't flown public in a decade. There was no chance he was ever going there. So you handled these issues to give John Calipari a very real offer. If you really think Jamie Dixon is the best coach for your job, what are you doing? Like, you got together $48 million or whatever for 6 years, and you can't get together $6 million or whatever, or $3.5 million to split the buyout with Jamie Dixon? Like,
I understand the hesitancy because,
it's Jamie Dixon versus John Calipari.
And it's also like, do you really want to pay $8 million to buy out for Jamie Dixon? I don't know if I want to pay $8 million for a buyout for Jamie Diggs. I think he's good. I think he would do a fine job there. I don't know if I want to pay $8 million to buy him out. But if you're UCLA and you're trying to tell people that, like, oh, yeah, we're going to invest. We're willing to spend now. It's going to be different. And you're over here haggling over, like, a couple million dollars for a buyout?
Yeah.
That's when it becomes a problem. And here's the other problem. When it leaks that he's the guy, Before you got this done and you got this figured out, what you're going to do with the buyout. You can't let it leak that he's the guy before he is the guy. He's not the guy if you don't have an answer to the buyout.
You can't even let it leak before you're done haggling over the buyout.
Yes. They messed this up so badly.
It just looks bad if you're still haggling
over the buyout. And that's the thing about it. Like, Jamie Dixon, I don't want to say he'd be a great hire. He's not a home run hire. He's not the best hire you can make. But he's good. I think he'd do fine there. He's not a bad coach.
A solid B-plus hire. Like,
right there, yes. But the problem is,
like, he's better. Like,
everything about this is embarrassing, and you didn't get these big names that you made people expect. Like,
and this is the second time in a row, by the way, this happened.
Everything, like, life is about expectations, right? Like, part of the reason why some coaches end up getting fired in jobs, even when you think they do a good job, like maybe a Ben Howland, is because of the expectation that you set, right? It's kind of like
the coaching staff or the fan base at UCLA was done with Steve Alford after he made three Sweet 16s in 5 years or whatever, which is like, you know what, like, I'm not going to sit here and like defend Steve Alford, you know, like, I think that he got a little bit of a bad rap at times, but like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you Steve Alford is a world beater as a head coach. Yep. You know what I mean? Do I think UCLA made the right decision moving on? Yes, I do. But at the end of the day, when your standard is you have to surpass three Final Fours in five, or three Sweet 16s in 5 years, that's a tough standard. Yeah. That's a really hard standard.
And here's the perfect example, then we can end it with this. Archie Miller this year, at the start of the year, he beat the shit out of Marquette early.
Yep.
They beat Louisville early, and they had another win that I'm blanking on that was early on. That set a level of expectation for what the season was going to be for Indiana. When you combine that level of expectation with the fact that they got Romeo Langford coming in, all of a sudden this was the next great Indiana team. All these Indiana fans think they're going to win the Big Ten. They're going to end up making a run of the tournament. And the fact of the matter is, this team is young. They're young where you don't want to be young. They're injured, and they're not really all that good.
Well, I'll say this about UCLA too. The guys that they got in terms of recruiting rankings, right? Their recruiting rankings over the last, and look, like, I fell into this trap. I wrote about it. Like, I wrote about, oh my God, UCLA is doing so great, recruiting all these, like, great players. I was very wrong because I saw them get on campus. They weren't, but they were rated. Like, Jalen Hands was a 5-star prospect. Jalen Hands, like, I think he's a Pac-12 player, but, like, I'm not certain that I would want him on my Pac-12 team either. In terms of talent, he's a Pac-12 player, but, like, look, you know, you can go up and down this, like, up and down their recruiting rankings, and you can be like, look, like, this is probably a Pac-12 player. But there's, like, it's situational whether or not he is. So a lot of this also, whenever you get informed by recruiting rankings, which is what happens with expectations, right? These recruiting rankings are first, second, first, like, fifth for UCLA. It becomes really difficult to overcome those expectations, especially whenever you bring in the wrong kids from a certain program down in Southern California, and that be your recruiting base. So, look, at the end of the day, like, UCLA's search has been problematic. I like that they're bringing in what I consider, if it's Jamie Dixon, obviously, what I consider to be a smart basketball mind. A lot of it is going to be dependent on getting the right staff. I'd be very interested to see if Dwayne Broussard ends up returning with them after he got hired at TCU. Be very interested to see if Ryan Miller would go with Jamie Dixon. Very interested to see just who he gets to handle the Southern California recruiting base. Because we know Jamie can coach. It's just whether or not he can get the kids. I would venture that he can, to be honest. And I think that UCLA, in a lot of ways, automatically recruits itself, at least with a certain level of kid. Mm-hmm. You just got to get the kids that fit you and fit your style. And I don't know that Steve Alford ever did that. I think he recruited off of recruiting rankings a little more than he recruited off of, this guy fits what we want to do.
Yeah. I agree totally. Sam, I know you have to go get your beverages. So
yeah, I'm going out. Like, I'll be real. Like, I don't have a crazy amount to do here this week. Like, I just ran my top 100. Yeah. So I'm good.
Your job is to network, and the best way to network is to get to the bar. So I'm going to let you get to the bar. I appreciate the time, sir. It's I think that might be the last time that I have you on. Maybe we'll do a Sunday night,
ever
late night.
Christ,
no, just for the season. We're wrapping things up.
Shit, we like text every day. Like, yeah. am I getting ghosted here? Like,
no, you're getting cut. I'm Team Reeks these days. You come here. You've had some poor takes recently. So,
clearly,
yeah. Well, I appreciate the time. As always, go find him on the Game Theory Podcast. You can find him at The Athletic. And you could probably find him tweeting some nonsense about movies and adoptable cats. So,
Don't go see Bohemian Rhapsody. It was garbage.
There you go. Sam, I appreciate the time, man.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Follow me on Twitter.
Give me 5 stars.